Welcome to the Failing Writers Podcast. Like the warm bubble bath of procrastination. Soothing. And relaxing. But eventually, it goes a bit cold. Bits of you wrinkle, and you just want to get out.
Hey, Tommy.
Hello, John. Welcome back.
Hello.
Nice to see you again.
Can I share something with you, Tommy, before we, like, properly start the podcast in a proper way?
Yeah, go on then.
It was just something very much in our wheelhouse.
Right.
I was going to say ball pool then.
In our ball pool.
That's weird, isn't it?
I don't know, but it's a nice metaphorical idiom that you've made up there. I like that.
Yeah. Isn't it? I'm going to start using that. This is just some nice copywriting that I spotted out in the wild, and I thought it'd be nice to share with you. So Katie and I took a client out recently, and they very kindly gifted us a little scent library from Penhaligon's Perfumiers. But it turned out that the real treat was not the range of fragrances. It was actually the little booklet that came with them. And I would love to know who wrote these, because I genuinely think they're brilliant. Okay, so this is a fragrance called Helvetii from the little booklet. So this is love. An intoxicating, mysterious fragrance. Vigorous grapefruit. Levantine spice and rose tangle in the moonlight. But what's that upon the riverbank? Could it be the fabled black rose?
Wow.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah.
Isn't that strong? This is a particularly good one as well. This is from a perfume called The Favourite. Waiting won't do for this lady. She knows exactly what goes on behind palace doors. And her golden mimosa sways society's opinion. Her majestic scent of iris and musk greets with a darling smile as she begins to emerge on a sandalwood stage. It's quite nice, isn't it?
Yeah.
And this one is particularly lovely. I like this one. This is called, the perfume is called The Coveted Duchess Rose. Rose's coy eau de parfum conceals something more sensual, a hint of musky wood. Alas, the Duke is off gallivanting while his sweet young bride aches with desire. Won't someone, anyone, release her?
Wow. They're like, I wonder if the brief was, can you write something that is like those mental perfume ads you see on TV?
I think that's exactly it.
Because it kind of is that, but it's so much nicer, isn't it, in the written word, than it is on those weird ones where they're like just drive into the middle of a desert, kill a wolf, and then eat a cheesecake or something. You're like, what? What's happened? What?
I just think they're great. I've got one last one.
Lovely.
This is The Tragedy of Lord George.
Wow.
Do come in. I'm sure we've met before. Noble patriarch, paragon of masculine elegance, Lord George welcomes with a scent of shaving soap and warming rum. But what secrets hide behind tradition?
Yeah, I think we do need to find out who wrote them and get them to write our next entry for a 100-word story competition.
I think so too.
I think they would be very good at that.
I think they would.
Yeah.
Whoever that is, they have to be saluted.
Yeah.
Because they're not only sticking to the brief and presumably also whatever the client's particular whims are, but they're also clearly having quite a lot of fun as well.
Hey, and from as we know, well done to the client as well for not ruining it completely.
Yeah, exactly. Letting them happen.
Letting the talent happen.
Yeah, I thought they were quite fun.
Yeah.
So yeah, whoever that is, if anyone knows them, let us know. But I thought they were excellent.
Well, thank you for sharing, John.
Oh, you're very welcome. Tom, what have we got on the podcast this week?
We are having a chat with the lovely Laura Barton, who is a journalist, writer, novelist, just everythingist, isn't she really?
I don't think she does everything, to be fair.
Writing-wise.
Yeah, she's dipped her toe in a few pools.
Yeah.
A few ball pools.
And we asked her on the show, really, on the back of kind of falling in love with the things that she'd done on Radio 4 that are available on BBC Sounds. We'll put links in the show notes.
Yeah.
That are sort of essays on music, but in a broad, in-depth, very human, personal way, really, I guess. Because they're difficult to describe in a way. You kind of need to listen to them because they have their own sort of...
Well, they're really soundscapey, aren't they?
Yeah, I was just say they have very much their own atmosphere and style to them.
Yeah, they're very beautifully produced.
And somewhat hypnotic in places, I think it's fair to say.
Mm.
So, well, without further ado, let's have a chitty chat with Laura Barton. Laura Barton, thank you very much for joining us. Welcome to the Failing Writers podcast.
That's a pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
A lot of people are put off by the title of the podcast, but...
I felt at home with it. That,
do you know, you'd be astounded the number of people we have on that kind of... doesn't matter the levels of success they have, go, well, we're all failing, aren't we? We're all failing.
Exactly, exactly. I don't think you ever get past that. It's part of the job,
well,
I think.
We'll start there. Do you still get that? Do you have any... I mean, obviously, you've done so many different things, sort of... Where would you put yourself in terms of what kind of... I was going to say what kind of writer you are then. That's a bit presumptuous of me, isn't it? Where would you put yourself? Because journalist doesn't seem to really cut it, does it? But that's part of it.
I was thinking essayist.
Oh, that's nice. Maybe I'll start saying essayist.
It's very, very 1800s. I like that. Yeah,
it is.
Like
it bring is, it, yeah. Bring it like back.
Hazlitt,
yeah.
Yeah.
I tend to these days say writer and broadcaster.
Right, yeah.
But it took me... I mean, it took me a long time to say writer. But, you know, by the time I'd sort of confidently started saying writer, if I went through customs or whatever, I'd already written a novel and done all this kind of stuff. But yes, I write journalism, books, radio. I've got a screenplay project thing on the go. And then I do other stuff as well. So I run the spoken word stage at Green Man Festival, and I do A&R for a record company. So I do quite a mixture.
So you just say whatever suits at the time, depending on who's
paying. Whatever sounds cool to the person I'm talking to.
That's a big... hat cupboard, that is.
It's an exhausting hat cupboard sometimes, yes. I'm about to take a week off, so you find me at the end of my tether, out of words.
Well, if we can go to the other end of the tether, when the tether started, where was the start of that tether? Where did it all start for you as writing?
I guess sort of I always loved writing at school. That's the most dweeby reply, isn't it? And then I studied English at university and edited the student newspaper, and I won a couple of writing prizes, and then I went to The Guardian. It's been a very jammy route, and be the first person to tell you that. And then, so I've just always written. I was one of those really weird children that doesn't speak until they're quite old. And I think I just...
Like 16, 17? What was it?
More like 18.
Wow. How old are we talking?
I did speak, by the time I was like 5 or something, but only to certain people. And I think I wrote because I was so shy. And then, of course, the thing is that... you become a writer and then people ask you to go on podcasts or give talks and things. And you're like, but this is why I got into it.
I didn't want to do this bit. I just wanted to sit in a
room.
Please
don't make me speak. with no one looking at me. I've just always, it's always been my sort of, it feels silly to say, but sort of primary mode of communication. So.
Well, I think that comes across in a lot of your writing. I mean, I'm a huge fan of your work you've done with the BBC, the audio work.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, no, that's my favourite stuff to do, really, radio.
Mm. Oh, it's just amazing to listen to.
Thank you.
Really
thank
is. You. I was going to ask, actually, jumping all around on the questions.
That
here,
is fine. That's
but
fine.
Obviously, your music is a massive part of your life, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
I was going to ask where that came from. Let's do that question first.
Okay.
Where did that come from?
Well,
was that because you weren't talking, you just sat listening to music?
I mean, also, it's important, not important, in the scheme of things, not important, but I didn't really write about music for years because I loved it so much. And I kind of thought, I can't write about this thing I love so much.
Oh, wow.
but my parents listened to a lot of music, and I think it's just as simple as that, really. And I guess my mum, I've spoken about this in other places before, but my mum used to listen when I was really young to John Betjeman's albums, and John Betjeman having been the poet laureate. And Jim Parker, this producer, set his poetry to music with Betjeman reading them in the late 70s. And I think they were sort of the earliest music I heard. And I think it really melded this idea of like words and music in my head. So, but my parents just listen to music constantly. And it's a sort of, to this day, my dad's 80 and I'll still go home and he'll be like, have you heard the new, I don't know, King Cruel album?
Wow.
And so it's still a massive source of communication between us. So yeah, grew out of that.
Do you play music at all? Because I was wondering in some ways it's better
not to
have studied music in order to write about it.
That's interesting. I think there is a sense of wonder, probably. I mean, I played played euphonium in a brass band when I was at school.
Whoa, you are so cool, Laura. This is amazing.
That wasn't cool when you're 12. no. And I played it badly. I mean, so I did that and I played bass for a little bit, but not really. I'd love to have played an instrument, really, but it wasn't really on the cards. Mm. I should maybe take it up now. But I agree with what you're saying, though. I think it's an interesting thing about trying to understand something through language.
Yeah.
That is, and, you know, my big thing is that music fills in the spaces that words can't quite in terms of feeling. So hopefully, I think I try to find a way to write about music that is sort of inherently musical.
Yeah.
Or inherently... rhythm is a massive thing in the way that I write.
Yeah. So, you talk about it very personally as well.
Yeah.
Like in the way it affects you specifically, and you're very open and honest about that, which I think works very well.
I think when I first started doing it, that came out of the music editor then at The Guardian asking me to write a column.
Mm.
And that grew out of conversations we'd had about music in our lives. And at the time, people didn't write about music that way. It was a very funny but quite vicious era of music writing.
Yeah.
So to write about it in a sort of intimate way was quite different. And I was a bit nervous about that at first. But, you know, people responded to it, and hopefully I'm doing something right. I think there are so many different ways to write about music that aren't just sort of about facts and competing and putting things down. So
when I was thinking about your writing, this is kind of the other side of that coin. I don't know whether you've ever considered this, but do you think that your obsession with music has influenced the way that you write? Because I think your writing is very lyrical, really, in how it rolls along. Maybe it's that rhythm you spoke about as well, but in the sort of the choice of metaphors and words that you use, it's very musical.
That's very nice thing to hear, thank you. I think so, definitely. I think that, and poetry, I love poetry.
Yeah,
I always say that when in my 80s I'm gonna write poetry. So
sat there playing your euphonium writing poetry.
Oh god,
that'll be great days to come.
The decade. Yes, I think it must have done. It absolutely must have done. And I kind of like, put it more and more, the older I get and the more confident I get as a writer, I suppose I fall onto techniques, or sort of I don't know how to say it, but a less fully explanatory way of writing. Part of this comes from writing a lot for radio. I feel awkward in a lot of some more journalistic writing when people want you to explain things to the absolute nth degree.
Yeah.
I like that sort of more ambiguous space, or just relying on the sort of, I'm going to sound like an absolute twat, but sort of the potency of words.
Oh, yeah, the potency of words. Sort of,
you know, the potency of words. You're allowed to say that on a writing podcast, right?
Yeah, no, I should. Yeah, true.
Do you want an even twattier thing that I can say?
Definitely.
Which
yes,
is,
please.
Thank you. I always think of words like, do you know those plants, Indian balsam?
No.
Where you touch them and you'll see them by the side of railway verges, and they're those kind of tall, purpley flowers, and you touch them and they spring open and they send sort of pods at their sort of seeds everywhere. Yeah. I think words can be like that. That's basically my weird approach to language. And I think the more you lean into the fact that a word is working really hard, you don't have to kind of explain everything completely.
You can see how that works quite well with music, because music's quite similar.
For sure, yeah.
How did the Notes series come about? Did you get asked by the BBC, or were you kind of looking around to do something like that?
So I'd done quite a lot of stuff for Radio 4, and I work a lot with a producer called Alan Hall with a company called Falling Tree, and he and I have a very good working relationship. He studied music, actually, so I wonder if that's part of it. But he's an amazing producer, and that company win all the sort of awards. And he's quietly rebellious in the way that he structures radio programs. So he does quite interesting things with, you know, even just like 28-minute radio program. So we really enjoyed working together, and he basically came up with it. And I think Radio 4 were looking for more music content, but it kind of grew out of that. And then they sort of, there are various commissioning rounds, as I'm sure you know, in radio.
Mm.
But I think we told them about the types of things we were going to do, but without entirely knowing what we were going to do. And then that first series we obviously had to make during lockdown. So that was added another layer to it. But it sort of grew into its own thing, I guess.
No, it's great.
It's a lovely series. That. And I like the way it's the sort of the jumping off point for each one, the starting point. It's just entitled Bells.
Yeah.
Or something like, you know, it's kind of just like,
that'll do.
It's a lovely wandering It's exactly the kind of thing you'd expect if you transported an 1800s essayist into the present day.
That they really were embracing this essayist idea. Thank you.
Isn't it? Yeah. That's the kind of thing they would do. It's just it's just a
here are some thoughts.
A beautiful meander through the subject that's kind of loosely tied together. But
yeah, I mean, I do love. There are certain writers that I really love. Like I'm going to say the obvious, but Rebecca Solnit, who does that. You know, she draws together all these sort of disparate ideas and reference points, and makes something very beautiful and illuminating out of that, but without sort of having to say, here is all the knowledge I have on this subject.
Yeah.
You know, and I find that really refreshing.
Let's get on to your new book.
Mm-hmm. It's not out for a bit though, but yes, we can talk about it now.
Well, I think it will be out when we do this, actually.
It will be out when we put it out. Let's pretend it is out.
Let's pretend.
So we're in the future.
Let's talk about your new book.
The one that's currently out, John.
It's come out recently.
I'm so proud of it, yes.
It's called Sad Songs, mm-hmm. a memoir. Mm-hmm. Yeah, tell us a bit about that. Well, firstly, maybe what led to it? Because I know you went through a particularly tough period of your life.
I went through a bleak period in my life when I got divorced, and I left my job at The Guardian and got divorced, got into another relationship that was really a very bad relationship, and then just had a massive breakdown. Mm. And I think it's one of those things when you take away all of your identities, really. You know, I'd been a Guardian writer for a decade, and I'd been married basically in a relationship for a decade, and you're not quite sure who you are anymore, and you have to start again. And sort of with that bleak time, I couldn't really write, and I couldn't really listen to music, and those were again sort of huge sources of identity for me. And so I sort of gave myself a challenge where I went to the States, to the Southern States of America, and traveled through looking at different genres of music and sort of seeing how they approach sadness. Mm. But talking about music, sort of sadness in music in general, and you know, obviously a lot of memoir woven in. It's not an exhaustive history. For the last few years that I've been writing it, people keep saying, well, I sincerely hope you're including this song by Elvis Costello, or I can see, do you address this
They'll
issue?
Always be that. Oh my God. You can't cover everything.
Oh, it's exhausting. But they will, people, it's not, you know, there is some musicology in there, of course, but it's not a sort of fact book.
Yeah.
I mean, you've listened to notes. It's kind of along those lines, that kind of tone. Yeah. So, yes.
Please tell me you're doing an audio.
I am. Though. Don't you worry. Yes.
I'm guessing you won't. I suppose you won't be able to pepper the audiobook with music, though, will you? Because you'd have to pay a fortune.
Unless the rights change, sadly. I mean, I think that's a real. Something's got to change in that world, I guess.
Mm. So, writing that book, Laura, was that? I mean, was it therapeutic then, or was it just a really hard thing to do that you decided to do? Like, what was? Where did it sit in terms of?
It was therapeutic. It's not as if I sort of write. You know, there's that whole trend now, isn't there? Writing to heal and journaling and stuff. And I get a bit snooty about all that kind of stuff, but not snooty.
I mean, that's why I kind of hesitate to say it, because it is a bit kind of like, oh, it was really cathartic, you know? Yeah, it was really. Like...
I mean, I'm not that type of person at all. People tend to think I'm this sort of slightly whimsical person, and I'm really not. It did help. It did help to set it all down. And I think there are certain parts, there was one chapter that I wrote that was some of the hardest stuff of my life. And then it wasn't something you could publish, really, but I had to write it. And then it probably is now boiled down to about two sentences.
Right.
But I think when I teach writing a couple of times a year, and we tend to sort of encourage the students to do that if they're writing something that's very grueling. Because you become quite scared of something. It's like the monster under the bed, right? So if you turn the lights on, then you realize that you can do it, you can write it, and actually you can encapsulate it. And just doing that is it's putting down a very heavy suitcase. I've mixed all kinds of metaphors of suitcases and monsters there, but I'm sure you know what I mean. I mean, I think I didn't really write in a very personal way. I mean, I wrote in a way that I think was intimate, but didn't divulge a lot of stuff about myself and my life until maybe like 10 years ago. And in the process of writing about myself, I realized not only was it a relief to sometimes set the record straight or say the things I absolutely wanted to say, but people responded to those pieces and those things more than any other. So I just decided, I always say this phrase, like, don't flinch. And that's sort of been my little mantra as I was writing the book and writing lots of other stuff. Now,
even though it's slightly terrifying, I think, writing about yourself.
Yes.
In very personal ways. Yeah.
It is, but sometimes I think you get to a point in your life where it's a relief. You know, people make assumptions about you, and it's quite good to kind of say, actually, no, that's not who I am, or that's not how it was.
I guess that journey in the States as well, that gave you a purpose at the time.
Oh, God, yeah.
And it gave you a focus and something to do.
Yes, I cannot say enough that I was absolutely in the depths of myself and completely crackers. And and I needed some kind of structure and some purpose, absolutely. So, yes, you know, there are parts of that time in my life that I don't even properly remember. So, which probably makes me an unreliable narrator. But but I absolutely needed that. You're right. Yeah, I needed a destination at the end, certainly. Mm.
And so what was that journey like in a literal sense, not in any kind of psychological sense, going through America?
Well, I mean, I'm a big fan of the solo road trip, well, road trips in general, but particularly solo road trips. And if anything is a little bit amiss or I feel a bit out of sorts,
right,
that's the balm for me if I can do it. That was a sort of, it did feel a sort of last desperate punt for something to regain myself when I was doing it. I do remember that. And I remember how few people I spoke to, which is sort of, when you sit down then to write about it, you realize, oh God, I just kept to myself, which I mean, I live by myself. I really love being by myself. So that's sort of a happy state for me, but also it's strange to sort of feel you're moving through somewhere and not really touching the sides, and no one would necessarily notice that you've been there. So, it was the start of the year. So it was quite a sort of weird time and of year to be sort of traveling through the South. It's not that sort of balmy heat that a lot of us would think of. And then actually before I went on it, some reason I decided I was going to go to, Mexico first and then fly to America from Mexico. And I went to Tulum and stayed in this hotel where I was the only person not on honeymoon. And I was just this sort of
that's just what you needed at the time, isn't it? Was that the perfect figure,
just at breakfast and sort of on the beach crying behind my sunglasses, unable to read. So I remember, I think I had a VSI Paul book with me and I was just turning pages thinking, does it look as if I've finished this page?
At least you got two chocolates on your bed.
Exactly.
Yeah,
that's a very good point.
Champagne.
Yeah. Complimentary bubbly.
Yeah, just crying into my champagne. Yeah.
Wow.
Without giving the book away, what did you discover about sad music that maybe you didn't know before? Do you know what I mean? Did you have a kind of epiphany on that journey?
I don't know if I'd call it an epiphany, but you know, there are lots of things. So I went shape note singing. I don't know if you know shape note singing or sacred art.
What's that?
It's this insane, I shouldn't call it that, but it's just sort of compelling, strange music that came across from, I guess, from Scotland, basically, largely, to the New World, as they would call it. And it's this very dour religious lyrics about how everything's better when we die. And but it was sung without instrumentation. And the shape notes are, so the songbook is called, I think it's the Sacred Harp book or the Sacred Harp. And then there are all these different notes. I'm going to try and remember. I can't remember off the top of my head what they're all called, but they all represent a different, it's like do re mi kind of sounds. And people sit in their groups, or they know which shape they're singing.
Oh.
And if you've ever watched Cold Mountain, that film, the adaptation of the book, it feels peculiar and ancient and incredibly moving to be around people singing it, to be in the heart of it. Look it up on YouTube, because it's extraordinary. It's almost like it's got this sort of sour quality to it. Somebody I know once called it white gospel. It is a little bit like that. So I went to do that in North Carolina, and I went to Al Green's church. And, you know, there's loads of stuff about the idea that you can't go back, which is obviously a huge thing in the blues. And what else did I look at? Soul, rock and roll, country. You've got a lot of those same sort of...
There are threads that run through them, I guess.
Yeah, so like things. sort of descending, three-part descending chord sequences and things like that. There are definite threads. But, you know, obviously the blues and soul and gospel reflect very particular struggles of African Americans. You know, country generally reflects the poor white working class of America. So, you know, different struggles. But yeah, it is really interesting that despite those differences, you've got sort of those real, very human echoes of, you know, certain notes allegedly being sadder than others. Those kinds of things.
And can we expect a second book called Happy Songs, where it's just it's just all cheerful stuff?
The Venga Boys.
Exactly. Wow. It's pure Venga Boys. And then if we make it a trilogy, I'll just do it's all right. Mediocre songs.
Nondescript songs. Yeah. There's quite a few that would be in that.
I'm going to ask you a very, very difficult question now. What is the saddest song of all time for Laura?
For me?
I mean, it has to be personal, I suppose, doesn't it?
It's so hard. I think...
is the one that just is guaranteed to set you
off. I'm going to say two. Can I say two?
Yeah, you can say two. Yeah.
That's cheating. I love I See a Darkness, whether it's the Johnny Cash version or the Will Oldham version, Bonnie Prince Billy version. But I can't remember which guys he did it in. I think Will Oldham. That one just destroys me. And then also... Graceland, Paul Simon's Graceland, which obviously has a sort of, it has a jolliness to its rhythm, but sort of what motivated the structure of my journey on this trip was ending up at Graceland. And and he wrote that song after his divorce. And there's that line about losing love is like a window in your heart. Everybody sees you're blown apart. Everybody feels the wind blow. And I think Paul Simon is like one of the most incredible constructor of lyrics. I just think the sorrow in that lyric and those lyrics in general, they always sort of catch me amidships, you know. I think they're amazing.
I think timing is probably key to the perfect sad song.
Oh yeah,
in a way
that it kind of tunes into you.
Heard it at a particular time or
I
think also that the idea of sort of the sad song being wrapped up in quite a jolly melody is
it's something
that kind of gets under your skin, I think, doesn't it? Because it kind of, it uses all the tricks of music to get in your head and burrow into you. But it's delivering this kind of somber, melancholy message at the same time.
I think a lot of disco songs are actually really sad, aren't they? Lyrically. But musically, they're kind of...
That's a perfect example. I have no idea. Are they? That's scary. You can't help dancing. That's the ultimate cheat.
Yeah, a lot of ones about crying on the dance floor.
Yeah, songs that kind of, songs about yearning tend to be very sad. But they're always kind of imbued with some hope, which almost makes it sadder in a way. It's like a lot of Springsteen is yearning, completely. You know, wanting to be. Wanting to be in a better place or a better life.
Absolutely. Somewhere.
But there's still is the hope of that.
Sprinkling of nostalgia. But then it's kind of snatching it back away from
And then it's gone. What are your favourite sad songs?
Oh, hold on a minute.
You're interviewing an interviewer. It's very hard.
That's clever.
That is clever. Turning the tables. Oh, I was thinking about this the other day because I was thinking about this question. I mean, Danny Boy's got to be a contender, hasn't it? Just as a song.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a killer.
It is.
One of my favourite sad songs, I think I sort of came to rest on, is Restax.
Oh, my God.
Bon Iver.
I can listen to that.
That is every single time I hear that.
I mean, that whole album. Gets me.
And I think it is the context of that album as well is quite a powerful sort of symbol, isn't it, as well?
Of the isolation. Do you mean that one?
And trying to kind of turn your life around or being at a junction in your life.
It's not the idea of sort of defiant, I'm getting over you. It's the idea, I always love that line about your love will be safe with me. But it's like you're the unlocking and the lift away, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think for me, it's back to how it makes you feel at the time, isn't it? Of kind of going under and being kind of overwhelmed by stuff is Frog Chorus by Paul McCartney.
That's a killer.
I loved that song.
I do actually that song. And people generally don't, though, do they? Yeah. It's like a bit it's a joke.
Well,
and it's a really good song.
It's a brilliant song. People make jokes about Mull of Kintyre makes me incredibly wistful. You know,
I think that was number one on the day I was born.
Was it?
Well, I can tell.
Whatever that means. I did once have an idea that you could, you know, kind of, you know, like star signs. I thought it might be more accurate to see what people's first, what was number one when you were born?
Mine was yes, sir, I can boogie.
Well, there we go. If ever was proof.
I think mine was Barry White.
Well, case closed, Your Honour.
I know, exactly.
I think proving it. Well, that was a good chunk of the Failing Writers podcast, wasn't it? I don't know about you, but it makes me fancy listening to a bit more of it. Look, what do you know? Here comes some more.
Laura, you wrote a novel way back many moons ago.
I did, yes.
Called 21 Locks. I mean, I know that you know this already.
Acting surprised would be
I do try to forget it, but yes, go on.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to ask you. Do you look back on that experience fondly?
No.
That was a very well-phrased question, yes. John.
I do and I don't. I mean, it won a prize and it allowed me to leave my job and allowed me to leave my marriage and all that kind of stuff. And it allowed me to become a different writer. But no, I had no idea what I was doing.
How so? As in, you got an advance for it and it gave you some cash to go.
Yeah, so financially it allowed me to, and to think of myself differently. Mm. But I think I didn't know what I was doing and I was too, I think one of the things that has changed for me as a writer over the years is that I have become, it is that not flinching thing. So I now like writing what I actually think, whereas I think when I was younger, and I think a lot of writers, particularly women, when they're younger, they write to please.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah.
And I was still very much in that mode at the time. And it was sort of, it was a funny time. Not with the agent I was actually with then, but I'd had a previous agent who really wanted me to write sort of female-focused fiction. Mm. And I had wanted to write a book about music, and she'd said, why don't you write a book about music and female friendship, you know, that kind of thing. So I felt this, I didn't really know what my place was in writing. And now I'm a much sort of stronger person. I have my own sort of core fairly sorted. Yeah. So it was a very different process.
So would you consider writing another one, or you kind of just, you've put that away for the time?
No, I've had an idea for quite a few years. I've got this one, The Sad Songs, and then a book I'm doing about Springsteen, and then I would probably write another novel. But the idea I've had for a while is, it's, I like writing from a male perspective more than a female perspective, I've discovered over the years. Right. And so when I've done sort of radio plays and things, that's more liberating to me. So it's just sort of leaning into just all the things that can free your writing voice, I suppose. Because inevitably when you write a novel, people think it's actually just about yourself. And if it's not.
That is really true. Yeah.
And that all the characters are based, literally just based on people you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And people are like, which one is me? Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
As if you couldn't take bits of different things and think, which one's me?
Yeah, exactly. As if you don't have an imagination whatsoever.
When I contacted you about the interview and you said, is there anything in particular? I did have a little thought, didn't I, about any early writing that you may be embarrassed about.
I was thinking about this and I think,
and all your writings, but you couldn't find anything.
Everything was spotless. It was all fine. I mean, I did actually think to say my novel, but
John's already covered that. Yeah,
we've ticked that box. So, but I was thinking about how, you know, because obviously as a journalist, especially early on, you have your usual run of things that you mess up and people's names you get wrong or facts you get wrong and all that kind of.
Of course, that used to matter back in the day.
Not anymore. I know.
Not anymore.
What a fact.
Not in the post-truth society. We're fine.
I was thinking though about I've had interviews that have gone wrong, and I was thinking about how you then turn them around into something. Because you do get to write them up and have sort of final say. So, or even, I really hate asking interviewees about their personal lives. And I remember interviewing Ethan Hawke once, and I didn't ask him anything about Uma Thurman. And I filed the piece and I remember my editor saying, you haven't asked about Uma Thurman. And had to email his PR and go, I'm really sorry, could we just have a line about Uma Thurman?
Oh, man.
And he sent me like the world's longest email, you know, talking about the breakdown of his marriage, which we probably could have just published as was. So sometimes when things have sort of gone wrong, they can be to your advantage. And I think that's the thing as a writer. There's always another angle on stuff.
Yeah.
Another way to tell the story that this new twist brings it. Yeah.
I think that's true with any writing, isn't it? That we've had that a lot of, on the podcast, speaking to loads of different people, that nothing's wasted.
I think that's so true.
There's always some use for it. You might need to look at it from a completely different angle, or you might need to wait for 10 years till it becomes apparent, but nothing is ever really truly wasted.
Yeah, I think, was it David Quantick was talking about ideas that he's just put into different places, and that I completely do that all the time. I carry things around in my head. I mean, I don't ever write just for myself. I need a commission. I need someone to ask me to do something.
Yeah.
So I do carry those things in my head and think, oh, I'll put this idea here or this sentence here. But yeah, in terms of like embarrassing things, I mean, I'm fortunate in that I've never kept a diary. So I don't have any of those sort of toe curling teenage moments.
And a bit of teenage poetry slipped in there for good measure.
Yeah. So that's the thing. If you leave poetry till your 80s, you are saved that as well.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. That's the reason. That's I wondered what that was about. That's clever.
Yeah. Thank you.
You're listening to the Failing Writers Podcast. May we be your mouse on your writing journey. Muse. It says muse. Sorry.
I was going to ask, on this podcast, one of the things we like to do is set each other writing tasks, Tom and I.
Yeah.
And I was thinking it would be a really good challenge for us to write an article of some kind, an attempt to get it published in a newspaper.
So
I told John that this was nonsense and unrealistic. And that it's very much a closed shop.
Not always.
And at best, you might get it onto some blog
somewhere. Aim high, work backwards.
In my sort of naivety, I'm thinking, no, they just want an easy life. An editor wants an easy life. They want to be sent something, and if they think it's interesting, they'll go.
And John's like, well, it doesn't have to be on the front page of the Times. I'm going like page 5 or something.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, I was going to say, if we are going to attempt that, can you give us any pointers? Are you trying to tick boxes to make sure your article gets published? Or where do you start? Presumably you kind of contact an editor with a little proposal or something to start with.
Yeah. So, I mean, I always say to people, first of all, if you've not done it before, don't go in to, you know, the editor of, say, The Guardian Saturday magazine and say, I've got an idea for a cover interview in which I interview Kanye West. And everyone's going to go, well, why would we give you that to you? And also, how have you got access to Kanye West? And blah, 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 blah.
There goes John's bubble.
I'm so sorry. So aim sort of small, because as soon as editors trust you, they will give you more commissions.
What do you mean by small? Do you mean my local newspaper, or do you mean the article itself?
Yeah. So sort of The Guardian would have this sort of shortcut section, or, you know, one of those little, one of those sort of parts of any newspaper where it's a smallish snippet of an article. So it could be, yeah, I don't know, it could be 300, 500 words.
Yeah.
But if it's about something that you know specifically about.
Yeah.
So rather than some, just because your favourite album is, you know, Astral Weeks.
How the hell did you know that?
Oh, well, all sane people say that. Because, you know, the same response will be sort of, why do we ask you? What's your unique perspective? So it's better to write about something that you know, something in your area, or something you've experienced in your own life. So sometimes they have those sort of personal experience articles in newspapers and magazines, which is another potential one. And then write to absolute word count and write to deadline.
Right.
I mean, I say that as an absolute deadline surfer, but the first time you're doing it, do it to deadline and do it to word count.
The
number of people who file really over length on their first attempt, and you're like, just actually, there comes a point where it's about convenience for an editor. And then just try and unless it's a really personal piece, don't put yourself too much into it. One of the things that I think you find a lot in newer writers or younger writers, and they want to make everything first person. And one of the greatest skills of journalism is learning, I think, to take yourself out of it.
Right, yeah. Open it out to everyone.
Yeah. Yeah, because again, people will be like, well, why do we want your perspective on this?
Yeah. Frankly,
no, that's the other thing I said to John. That's exactly what I said to John.
But I realise I'm being contradictory now, but it could be something that you know.
Mm.
It could be, I don't know, in your allotment that you grow turnips in, someone has grown the world's biggest ever turnip, and it could be that could be quite a nice first person-y type piece. But you could also tell that story from the perspective of turnip growing in general in the UK when we've all been told to eat turnips, you know. So you're just, it's looking at what is the best way to tell that story.
Yeah.
Succinctly. But you should absolutely, people should pitch to newspapers and magazines, don't forget, always want new voices.
Yeah.
So, you know, don't.
Well, that's what I figured. Yeah, that's what I figured.
Don't shy away from it. Yeah, but it's emailing. Go ahead with that turnip story, for God's sake. I think don't.
Need to tell.
Yes, urgently. But don't write the whole article first.
Okay.
I always say write your email, your introductory email, you know, find out who the relevant editor is. Make your email slightly memorable. Usually that involves putting a funny line in there. And then possibly just tell them a little bit about yourself. Tell them what your idea is,
okay,
why you are the person to tell it.
So it's like a two-paragraph email, maybe three-paragraph max. Keep it pretty quick, but why should you be telling this story, basically, is the email.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
When we were writing advertising, we used to call that selling the sizzle, didn't we? Sell the sizzle of the sausage, not the sausage.
You always have a great phrase for it in advertising.
Yeah.
That's pretty much all we do.
We were just selling sizzle, weren't we? There were very rarely sausages around. It was just sizzle. But hey, it's a good grounding in writing to length and writing to deadline.
Well, that's true.
Writing radio ads.
You're more into it now, aren't you, Tom?
Yes.
Yeah, no, let's do it. I'm all for it. Yeah.
Brilliant.
You got me at turnip.
Yeah. Who isn't there for turnips?
I can hear the next Laura Barton BBC radio, you know, following on from
the sound of turnips.
17 and bells. It'd just be turnips.
Turnips. Yeah. All root vegetables.
Intimate walk through the allotments of the UK.
I'm selling myself. I mean, it's, yeah.
Well, what did we say before about I know ideas are wasted and things will come up again? The turnip, that turnip one's gone on the back burner for all of us.
Exactly. It's now just a race actually, to get it turnip in print.
I like to think we'll all do some turnip-related work in the future. And
I think we should.
And it will confuse, you know, the people. There's a lot of talk about turnips at the minute, isn't there? Where's all that come from? And just kind of the...
Well, you know, there are, you know, fashionable moments for vegetables, aren't there?
Yeah.
So. Do you know what this podcast needs right here? I think it needs like a John Betjeman, Jim Parker little tune about turnips.
Yeah. One of those ones where it's a little bit, what's the one, he goes, and Captain went from Darley. And it's kind of that, it's actually a brass band. No wonder I'm drawn to it. But we need that kind of music for turnips.
Okay.
Like a flump.
Okay, yeah.
Tucked behind the streets of Pinner, on the plot he's been allotted, in the twilight after dinner, turning clods, his stomach knotted. Each evening you'll find Gerald toiling to stave his craving brain, he stares at fresh-turned loam, the earthworms coiling, the scent of lilacs in the air. Four plots back, a strike of match, the spark amongst the plastic sheeting, where crouching in a turnip patch, a face lights up before retreating. Gerald squints and takes his thermos, strolls to where the shadow waits. Hello. Who's there? Gerald murmurs. It's Larry Bradshaw from number 8. Gerald passes him a cup, the slightest touch of Larry's hand, and tilts the flask to fill it up, their eyes converging as they stand. They talk of soil and raspberry cane blight, of brassicas and nematodes. They talk and talk into the night of what they themselves will never know. Gerald clocks his watch with shock and says, I'd best be off. Emma will be worried sick, then coughed an awkward cough. Gerald turned to leave, then stopped, the blushing heads of turnips bursting through the soil of Larry's plot. Was at once the very best and worst thing, then the enigmatic moment of infinite significance, Gerald's involuntary bestowment. Your turnips are magnificent.
Laura, I was going to ask. Mm-hmm. So obviously, you've interviewed an awful lot of people and an awful lot of musicians.
Yeah.
Like some of the best musicians in the world.
Yeah.
Out of those, who have been, or have any been, but who have been sort of the most inspirational to meet in the flesh? Because it's one thing listening to their output.
Yeah.
And sometimes meeting those people can be a bit of an anticlimax. Anyway, it can be, can't it? Because their artistic output can be very different from the person they are. Mm. Who are the ones you've met that have really kind of, you thought, wow?
I often say about how much I loved interviewing Iggy Pop.
Oh, okay. Oh.
I went to his house in Miami and we just sat by the river. And
was he wearing a shirt or?
Even better than this. And this isn't a sign of changing how you write, because I didn't put this in the article and I would do now. He was wearing a satin kimono, and at one point he stood up and went and to go indoors and it fell open and he was wearing nothing underneath. He went inside and put on some satin trousers though. So, he was just, he's such a smart man and he was so generous with his time. Quite often when you interview people at a certain point in their career, they've proven so many things that they are really happy to just take all the time and just be generous with their.
No, it's funny. Ooh. We had a very similar discussion the other day, actually. Yeah,
it's really lovely, isn't it? It's really interesting to see where somebody's at in their career just by exactly that. So, and it's just the sort of the intelligence and connectedness of thought and the way how deeply he'd thought about things and how genuinely he considered answers to the questions. That sounds really. Strange thing to say, but no, I adored him. I really did.
No, I don't think it is, though, is it? Because you have to remember these people have sat through a million interviews and have had the same questions. And there's an art form of not looking annoyed that someone's asked you for the 18th time about your wife, Uma Thurman.
Yes, exactly, right? But sometimes I always remember interviewing Pink, and she's perfected that thing of making it sound as if she's genuinely really answering your question, but then you realise she's answered, even with pretty much the same head tilt question, you know, just is so polished.
You could do a little compilation video.
You definitely could. So Iggy, I mean, our old friend Justin Vernon, Bon Iver, I've interviewed him for every album and I love him to bits, and he's such a lovely, generous person. He's funny because he doesn't... it's not that he's sort of private about the process. It's just, I think he's genuinely a genius and he just does what he does and doesn't then sort of analyze it too much.
He isn't able to talk about it. Not quite sure what's happened.
Yeah, exactly.
That's annoying, isn't it?
You get more stuff from him. But I love talking. I've just interviewed The National again for the millionth time. And, and I love speaking to them always. But then you're saying you interview, you know, I interviewed Smokey Robinson and it was in a casino in northern Wisconsin and he was northern Michigan. And he was just sort of playing golf against the wall and he doesn't really want to talk about motor. He wants to talk about golf. But then I've interviewed people like Robert Icke, the theatre director. I found him really inspirational. Oh, okay. I think there are just certain people you come away from just spending time with them and you just think, what a brilliant conversation and what a brilliant person. I love those. They remind you how lucky you are to do your job.
You know, you're saying there you've interviewed, say, like The National several times. How does that change the interview when it's someone that you know, to whatever extent it is? Do you mean where you've interviewed them, this is the sixth time?
Yeah, it's funny because I think some editors don't like you to have interviewed someone a lot. But to my mind, that's daft because you, again, without wishing to sound like a pretentious whatever, but there have been periods of time when Justin Vernon pretty much only be interviewed by me. And that's sort of got a sort of depth to the conversation.
Yeah, that's what I was, yeah.
Yeah. You can get to the nuts and bolts quicker, can't you?
Yeah.
There's a trust built up as well, isn't there? There's an openness that...
There's a trust...
Or not, maybe. That could be the other side of that coin, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so.
Hopefully there is.
But sometimes when they've got something's happened in their life or there's something about that record that is precious or needs to be handled in a particular way, they know that you are the person probably to talk about that. I seem to have, in the last few years, become the person who people send to do delicate interviews where someone's going to cry.
editor on the phone. No, we're going to have to get Laura Barson on this one.
And genuinely, I'm worried it's become that. So in The National interview, Matt Berninger, it'll be out by the time this comes out, but Matt Berninger cried and my editor was going, you should probably start with that. And I was like, trust me, I've written enough articles about people crying. You need to lead up to that. But no, I think it's a really, I love that. There are quite a few people that, you know, Sharon Van Etten Carrie Brownstein, like a lot of people who you just have this relationship with, and it's just a continuing conversation.
Mm. Yeah, that's a lovely way of putting it.
And I think that's a great privilege.
Definitely.
We always have an awkward pause about this far in.
It's fine.
It's just before I ask the question.
John's famous last question. What's next for you, Laura?
in my head, you're rubbing your hands.
What have you got planned?
It's like the DJ putting on New York, New York, and everyone knows it's time to go
home. Oh, no, everyone's
as soon as John's asked, as soon as John asks, what are you doing next?
You know, you.
Everyone's like, right, well, we're pretty much
you
know done.
You can go and
start
have your
packing
lunch
up, lads.
Oh, that's nice. What's next?
Well, we know about your spring. You're doing a Springsteen book, you were saying.
So that's sort of a bit like the...
That's exciting.
The radio programme. It came out of the radio programme I did about Bruce. Mm. So it's more a kind... It's not a sort of exhaustive... It's a story of Bruce Springsteen. It's more about my relationship with Bruce Springsteen. So that, and then...
Have you interviewed Bruce?
I haven't. I've met him twice and just sort of stood before him like a bumbling idiot. I'm going to see him next week, actually, in New York, and I'm super excited.
Oh, nice.
Yes. So
it's amazing that, isn't it? He's still doing it. And
oh my god,
it's not like he's doing it from a chair.
Honestly, my best mate went last
insane,
night.
Insane, the guy's.
Yeah, and he still rips his shirt open. Do you know what I mean? And you're just like, good for you, Bruce.
He is a force, isn't he? He's incredible.
Oh, he is a mighty force. So. That I various edits to things. I'm trying to think what else I've got. I mean, I've always got a million. I'm the worst at turning work down, so I just tend to take on too much stuff and then cry about it. And I'm really trying not to do that as much.
So your week off is just going to be you, like worrying about what's coming up and not really wanting to take a week off.
Do you know what? I think I've managed to do it this time. I think I've my best mate and I are. She lives in New York, and we're going to see Self Esteem, and we're going to see Bruce Springsteen, and then we're going down to Key West, and we're staying in Bon Iver's dad's holiday house.
Wow.
That's my little name drop for you.
I feel the showbiz brilliant. Alarm bell going off.
Yeah, might call in on Iggy down there. see if he's put his trousers on.
Taking some pants, yeah.
So I just, do you know what I need to do is read. I've got 700 million copies of The New Yorker unread over there and some books to, and you just need, you will know this, you just need to fill up on words because you do run out of words.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for spending a bit of time with us.
Yeah, we should do some clever ending saying we've run out of words, shouldn't we? And then link that in.
Nice.
Edit all that together. Yes. It sounds seamless. And
well, I guess you could say, Laura, that we have run out of words. So that's a good end to the interview.
Sublime. Yeah.
And thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on. And sorry if I was pretentious at times, but, you know.
Oh, no, that's those are some of our favourite bits.
Thanks. Great.
We'll highlight those. We'll put some music behind them, turn them into a little feature for that.
A little bit of string every time she gets pretentious. Thank you.
I don't think we've interviewed a journalist before, have we? That's a first. I think we've talked to people who've written the odd article, but I don't think we've done like a full-timer, a dyed-in-the-wool
I wish you wouldn't say things like that, because we can't remember everyone that's been on, and you're bound to insult someone by going.
No, I'm sure we haven't. I've thought about this. I've thought about it.
Okay.
I've been through the back catalogue. I'm sure there have been people who have written articles.
We've had some half-assed, part-timey journalists, is that what you're saying? But no proper ones. Like Laura.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Hey, do you know what was particularly sweet about that chat, Tommy? Usually in interviews, people will know this, you're a little bit cheeky with our guests sometimes. You're a little bit of a monkey.
Yeah.
But the level of reverence afforded Laura was quite beautiful.
Yeah, well...
You are a proper fan, aren't you?
I do enjoy her work, yeah. She's great.
Yeah, so. You could tell.
Good.
It was lovely. It was cute.
Oh, well, that's me, isn't
it? That's what it was.
Yeah.
Well. I don't think I've ever used that as a word to describe you, Tom.
Probably not. Maybe a first and a last.
But another piece of the puzzle.
Well, hey.
So, yeah, excellent. Enjoyed that.
Moving on, we have another listener that has been daft enough to send in their work to us.
Mm, we have indeed.
For our whippity-doo-dah, whippity-hey feature. that's what we're calling it this week. Phil Oddie has sent us in. And he's a previous entrant to our competitions.
Mm.
I did like what he called himself on the email he sent us in his sign-off. Long-time listener, occasional competition also ran. So there you go, very honest.
I think he didn't he come very close?
I think he did,
close to winning our little mini competition, didn't he?
So he sent us three chapters and a little outline of a book that he's working on. He's work in progress, obviously. Bloody long three chapters, wasn't it? It's like 12,000 words or something.
Oh my God.
Phil.
Mate.
Like an entire book, that, pretty much.
It's true.
But we read it because we said we would.
We're good like that.
Yeah.
So tell me, what did you think?
I've taken copious notes on this, John.
Have you?
Yeah, but before we discuss them, let's give people a little flavour of it with a little reading taken from it.
This is an excerpt from a few pages in from the beginning. Echoes by Phil Oddie. Through the glass partition that divided the carriages, I saw someone moving. Their shaven head and azure robe marked them out as a cleric, one of the devoted. I've never had much time for religion. It's never been there for me. But sometimes I'd like the comfort of being able to offload the failings in my psyche that it's designed to shield us from. I was about to look away, but the shot of deja vu I got when the man looked up and locked eyes with me took me by surprise and I froze. It was so familiar that I felt like I was looking straight at my brother. I reached for the bubble of the memory, but it floated from my grasp and then burst in the air, disappearing in front of me. The man looked away and the moment broke. I found myself breathless. To distract myself from the rush of awkwardness, I rummaged through my brown leather courier bag open on the table in front of me. I wasn't looking for anything, it was just something to do. I found an apple and some wax paper wrapped sandwiches I bought before I got on the train in a hurry, feeling undetermined. I decided not to unwrap them, as it looked like they were mayonnaise based and already leaking out. There was also a bundle of waterproofs wrapped around a bar of mint cake and a crumpled receipt, which I uncrumpled. It was for a pair of hiking boots, from a store I didn't recognise the name of. I couldn't remember ever owning any hiking boots. A vague memory of stopping to buy them drifted by, but that couldn't be real. I'd stopped nowhere. A dream, then? That was silly. I must have left it in there from a previous trip. I hadn't used the bag in a while. My tablet had worked its way to the bottom of the bag, apparently out of battery. That was more of a problem than my comm, because I needed it for the sales presentation. I was definitely going to need to buy a spare pack. I checked the pockets on the front and found my toothbrush and a change of underwear, so I hadn't been completely useless when packing. The train reached the end of the bridge and approached the city walls. We were still high above ground level, the track sitting on top of a towering embankment. Trinity. I closed my eyes and blew out. It was gonna be fine. This trip had the potential to be a big deal for me, but that was only a problem if I let it be. The train slid into a tunnel through the walls, a formidable perimeter some 10 meters deep. Momentary darkness. In the blackness, in the half second, I thought I heard someone whisper my name. I turned in the voice's direction, but all I could see was my reflection in the carriage window. I blinked. Not my reflection, not my face, but one that I recognized. An older face, an echo from a dream. Then the automatic fluorescent lights flooded the carriage and my features resolved. My face back where it should be in the glass. I shook my head. My mirror image shook his back. There was enough to deal with without conjuring up ghosts. I jiggled my leg nervously, watching the power cables snaking along the walls as we sped past. The train burst through the other side of the tunnel. The carriage lights clicked back off, but the light was different on this side of the wall. We remained high above street level, which was cast deep in shadow by the high-rise blocks that sprouted from the ground, shooting up to the top of the city walls, as if even they needed to find some cleaner air. At this level there was some, although the soot and grime coating the drying sheets that billowed from the balconies left no doubt cleaner didn't mean clean. The train slowed suddenly to crawl its way into the station, past windows, some of which were not boarded up, scrolling me past intimate snapshots of other people's lives. A couple entwined asleep on a single bed, their twisted bed covers just about preserving their modesty. A billboard, paper peeling, stuttering to advertise billboard space.
A mother feeding her infant in its high chair with a plastic spoon, scraping the corners of the bowl to ensure that they got every morsel that she couldn't afford to feed herself. A billboard, paper peeling, faded slogans replaced with the words "Fuck Chiguate" spray-painted across them. A rooftop garden, green shrubs defying the air quality. A brother and his toddling sister playing hide-and-seek precariously close to the edge. A window with "Fuck Chiguate" spray-painted across it. Beyond that, the dismal trash of a tweak palace, balloons and pipes and syringes and bodies strewn where they'd fallen. An old woman drinking tea in her rocking chair amongst the glitz and clutter of her refuge from the world she found herself in. A naked prostitute counting the credits that she'd been left, which would have been scant recompense for the services she had just rendered, even if she hadn't just found them to be short. An old man tending to his roses on his balcony, breathing deeply the poisonous air as if it were fresh from the northern exposure, a defiant gesture that would soon confine him to his bed. A clothed prostitute, but only just so, waiting for her client to arrive, hoping that the price she'd just quoted would be recompense not just for the services she'd offered, but also for those she would be obliged to provide on top. I had to fill in some of the details myself. But life, not necessarily pretty, not necessarily happy, passed my window. Trinity, it seemed, was teeming with it. So, Tommy.
Yeah.
Tommy, you've taken a lot of notes, you say. I think that's normally a bad sign.
No, that's a good thing. It's a good thing.
Oh, is it? That's good.
Hey,
I'm pleased you said that.
What's the first thing that struck you about this, John?
The first thing that struck me about this is that I just wanted to read more. I enjoyed it, and I was straight into the intrigue. The intrigue was high very early on. That's what I would go for. What about you?
The first thing that struck me was, bloody hell, he's gone first person.
Right. Interesting. Yeah.
Because it's not something I write in, and it's not... I think it's probably... I don't know. To me, it's quite a difficult thing to work with, really.
Mm. It's so common these days, though, isn't it? It's like... It is the way most people write, I think.
Do you think?
Yeah. Particularly these days. Yeah, it does seem to be the sort of the way people tend to go, I think. I mean, I don't have any, you know, particularly strong feelings either way.
No, I don't really.
It makes sense to have it first person, I think. And this really feels like it can't be anything else.
Yeah, I think it would distance it a bit too much, wouldn't it? In a third person narrative.
And we'll get into that in a minute.
But yeah, where to start, really?
I feel like we need to sort of, before we get into it, should we hear the outline that he sent?
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Go for it, Tom.
Estrell Beck doesn't want to be a software sales associate. Yet here he is, newly arrived in the city state of Trinity for a make or break meeting with a local administration department. Underprepared, undermotivated, and oversensitive, every little thing about this strange place seems to stress Estrell out. When he discovers a message scrawled on the back of a napkin in his own handwriting, telling him he's trapped in a time loop, he knows for sure that he's got himself in over his head. Then the administration building explodes.
Mm. See, that's a good little outline, I think.
Yeah, it is, actually.
That brings you in, doesn't it?
Yeah. I felt reading it, this isn't a criticism as such. I didn't know if it just... started off a little bit too slowly. I get that there's kind of a need to kind of build that world and the atmosphere and kind of almost the monotony of him travelling there.
Mm.
And I don't know if it's just because I really enjoyed it as he got later on. It was kind of looking back and thinking, oh. And I'm not saying you should jump straight into the action on it, because I do think you need that little build, and there's some lovely bits about him half recognising stuff that's obviously happened previously in the previous time loop or something. But I don't know if that first bit is... a bit too much kind of just first person train of thoughty, but without being really train of thought.
Mm.
If that makes sense.
Well, it's interesting you said that, Tom, because I had written in my little notes here, benefit from a trim.
Yeah, maybe that's it actually, yeah. That it only you I appreciate it needs to be there, but maybe it just needs to be a bit sharper.
That is it, I think. I think it's really, really good. I love the concept, and I like the way he writes, and I just think you need that first bit. You need the sort of mundane aspect, you know, before you get the contrast of the explosion and everything that goes on afterwards. But it feels like some of the description you could get rid of, and it actually wouldn't hurt at all.
Yeah,
there are bits where
maybe feels a tiny bit laboured in that.
Yeah,
first
just
bit,
but only a tiny bit. It's literally just like odd things. There's like sometimes he'll describe something, like he described a platform, and then at the end he'll say it was bleak or something. You think you don't really need to say that. You've basically just drawn a picture of a really bleak thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And then said it was bleak. It's just little tiny things like that.
No, no, it's that old thing of the show don't tell thing, isn't it? Which is an obvious thing, but yeah, sometimes there's a little bit of tell that creeps in. Because there was a bit I thought was brilliant where he's coming in on the train and it's talking about what he can see out the train window, and it mentions slogans on the walls of "fuck Chagati," but it doesn't go to explain who that is or what it is.
Yeah.
But then it comes in later and it mentions as a poster saying "vote Chagati."
Yeah.
And I think that's brilliant because that's just
setting things up. Yeah.
You've made me observe that, and I decide that there's obviously some kind of political power struggle, and people aren't happy. Some people are really unhappy with it. Feelings that run, you'd build all these different things in. And that's brilliant show, don't tell, isn't it?
There's more stuff with the window as well. There's the scenery going by, and he sort of glimpses into different people's lives. And he does this whole like little montage of seeing lots of people through their windows. And he also sees himself. And there's a really creepy bit where the person on the other side of the glass, his reflection, doesn't quite look like him. And there's just really, I really like the way he did that. He was using the view from the train as a sort of a little motif and a way of giving you little clues to what's about to come. I thought that was really good.
Yeah, so I think maybe just scooting through that and kind of just being really critical on himself and saying, right, is this showing or telling on stuff, I think would actually take a lot of the edges off that.
Yeah.
And you could probably, like you say, you could probably drop quite a bit of stuff out that's descriptive that doesn't necessarily need to be there. They see there's a bit where he's in the train station and he goes to the kiosk. It's like an information kiosk, and there's a interaction and some dialogue with the person in there who's a bit sort of robotic and bland and doesn't care, he's just doing his job. And there's a bit where he says, "Welcome to Trinity," the person in the booth. So it's "Welcome to Trinity." It seemed that the face, as he calls him, the face was continuing with his script regardless, with a little regard for what I just said. And I think something like that, it would be obvious. You could add into his "Welcome to Trinity," "Have a nice day, thanks for visiting," you know, something that sounds very scripted. Mm. And then you don't need to explain that he's continuing the script. You can kind of have it within the the world again. Within, so it's just little things like that, I think.
Yeah.
I would look.
But at. I thought we were talking about the world building and that we may be able to cut it back, but he does it very well. Like, I can see it all in my head now.
Yeah, but I think within that world as well, I think what he does well is the interaction of the protagonist within that world. You really pick up on the sort of the mild panic and confusion, and just he's slightly socially inept. Yeah.
His
just
characterization
kind of
is good.
A little bit fish out of water.
He could maybe even push that a bit more, because I'm guessing he's kind of he's presumably the protagonist, so he's got to sort of become the hero in some way, and to create that contrast might be nice for him to even be slightly more that.
Yeah,
way. I don't know.
There's a few hints about maybe what his wants and needs and what his struggle is, but there's not enough to like really set in stone what does he need, what's happening, where's the friction. There's little bits, isn't it, about him not liking his job and stuff, but you're not quite sure what the thing is.
Yeah, what does he really want? Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, maybe that needs,
or maybe he doesn't know. Maybe that's the point. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. I guess that's again from the first person thing.
Yeah, because he's obviously got a very wealthy father, and so he's maybe a little, I don't know whether he's a little bit spoilt or a little bit ignored. There's been a little bit of neglect there. I don't know.
Well, it feels like they've kind of never been able to get the recognition.
Stand on his own two feet.
Not being able to be a success and not being able to be a success in his father's eyes. Mm,
exactly. But I would happily read this.
Yeah.
I was sad when I could no longer turn the page on my Kindle. So there you go. That's a very good thing, I think.
Do you know what I did love?
What?
Something I thought was really, really good was when he first gets the message on the napkin.
Mm.
So on this napkin is written a message from himself to him in his own handwriting, that it wasn't cryptic or anything. It says, "You are in a time loop."
yeah.
And I thought that's really refreshing. It really struck me as, God.
Yeah, it's not going to take 20 chapters to get to the fact that...
yeah, there's a lot of filmmakers and novelists and writers that want to create, and they keep stuff back.
Mm.
And that just felt like, in terms of wanting to get into the story and read more, it made it feel like the author was being very honest.
Yeah.
Wasn't trying to, what you see is what you get. And I thought I thought it was really refreshing, actually.
It was. And I feel like by that stage, he's given us enough clues to get that there's something odd going on. There are people sort of recognising him, but not quite. And he's not quite sure. He doesn't remember packing his bag. There's several clues, aren't there? But it's really nice to get that, like you say. I did like that as well. And I also really like the fact that someone else has written on the napkin in a different writing and you don't know who that is.
See, which is intriguing, isn't it?
It is. And what that says and just how confusing it is also very good. So a big well done, I think, to Phil.
Absolutely. And I'm an absolute sucker for time loops and time travel.
Me too.
Stuff.
Love it.
So.
Yeah, brilliant. So next week, Tommy, next week we have got...
Nothing, John. We've got nothing
We've got nothing next week. So enjoy that. Enjoy a little bit of time off, everybody. Go on holiday.
Many people will say it's one of their favourite episodes of the Failing Writers Podcast.
The gaps.
Yeah. Mm.
But next episode...
That's a good way of putting it, yeah. Next episode.
Next episode, we've got a slightly forlorn but also fascinating chat with a writer called Louise Voss. And some of you might remember because she caused a small Twitter storm.
Yeah. It was a while back, wasn't it? It was in The Gap when we were off air.
It was.
So we recorded this quite a while ago.
We did. It was back in October of last year that she sent the tweet and we got in touch with her.
Because we're nothing if we're on the ball, aren't we? That's us. Do you know what I mean? Like finger on the pulse.
Straight on it.
A mere 6 or 7 months later, we are on the case. Tell you what.
It just feels like the right time to put it out now.
Yeah, and join us for in February 2026, we've got an episode on artificial intelligence, which could end up being a big thing. So,
So that tweet went like this. What's the word for sadness felt when you spend a year writing a book, then a fortnight after publication, your editor emails to say how disappointed they are with its sales? Basically, it's all over, just like that. And so we will be talking to Louise all about that tweet and all about her long and fascinating career and how she's seen the industry change. Lots of interesting insight. Also a lovely person.
Yeah.
Anything else to bring to the party, Tommy?
No, I think the party has ended, John.
Let's leave it there then.
Yeah.
And we'll catch up with you in a couple of weeks' time. Thank you for listening, everybody.
Yeah, and thanks to Phil Oddy for sending his work in. Really enjoyed that. That was really good.
And thanks to Laura for being on.
Oh, yeah, and we should give her book a little bit of a plug, shouldn't we? Sad Songs, available now. So, go out and get a copy.
In fact, I've just ordered it from my local bookshop.
Oh, good for you.
I'm saying it like that because...
Very worthy.
I don't think enough people use their local bookshop.
Not putting money in the pockets of the billionaires.
Mm. Exactly.
Yeah. So, out now in all good bookshops, as they say.
Go out and buy a copy right now.
Hello.
Where's everybody gone?